Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a TVO podcast.
Just a heads up that this episode discusses sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to On Docs, a podcast about documentaries and the stories they tell. I'm Colin Ellis.
And I'm Nam Kiwanuka.
And today we're going back to the 90s with two docs that tell different versions of the same disastrous event. HBO's Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage, and Netflix's Trainwreck, Woodstock 99. Both docs explore the events that transpire through the eyes of attendees, concert promoters, artists, and journalists. But before we get to the docs, we have a clip of a certain young VJ interviewing Sean Combs, or Puff Daddy as he was known back then. Let's take a listen.
Like Woodstock back in 69,
yeah,
message
I follow,
here.
I the whole scene. I mean, I don't really have a message right now, but just having a good time. You know, the millennium's about to drop. I'm just trying to enjoy people, enjoy life, the grass, the air, your pretty eyes. You know, I'm just on that type of vibe right now.
Okay, Nam. Tell us. What was it like to interview Puffy?
Okay, so I was at Woodstock, and I was acting as a production person. I was the videographer for Ed the Sock. Do you remember Ed the Sock?
Of course I remember Ed the Sock.
Yeah, so it was a very interesting perspective, walking through those crowds of a lot of dudes who were really drunk and dirty. and everybody loved Ed the Sock, and Ed can be a bit, you know, back in those days, he was kind of... I don't know. What was he known for, do you think?
I mean, he makes a lot of sarcastic comments about celebrities, about artists. I loved his when he would do the music videos, like he would make fun of the music videos. He was really hilarious.
He was hilarious, but he's always surrounded by beautiful young women. And so being around him and the crowd that was attracted to him was kind of interesting. Anyway, so I was hanging out by the bathroom. I look up and I'm like, oh, my God, that's Sean Combs. And Denise Donlan, who was my boss at the time at Much Music, she was like, go ask him for an interview. And I was like, well, there's no VJs around. She's like, you're doing the interview. I was like, what? Because I'm pretty sure I had like smelled like BO and it wasn't a place where you have makeup on or anything like that, right?
Well, as we see in the doc, wasn't a very good shower situation.
No. So anyway, I walked up to him and I said that I was a fan of his music. I like Biggie stuff. Did he have a moment to talk to us? And so that's how it happened. And that was actually my first time on camera at Much Music. My first interview. No notes, no nothing. I just went off the top of my head. And my boss, Denise, at the time was, as I mentioned, she was just standing a few feet away. So I was a little bit nervous as well because you're trying to impress her. And later on day three of Woodstock, she pushed me to do the live hit. She's like, you're going up with the rest of the VJs and you're going to do the live hit. And I was like, what? I've never done live television. And so while we're up there, that's when the fire started.
Oh, dear.
Red Hot Chili Peppers was on stage. And then all of a sudden, you see the smoke coming up on the scaffolding that we were standing on. And we all had to run down through the crowd.
Oh, my God.
It was complete and utter chaos.
To give some background to what we're going to talk about, Woodstock 99 was the 30th anniversary of the original Woodstock Music and Art Fair, which took place in 1969 during the height of the hippie movement and the war in Vietnam. And that event had artists like The Who, Jefferson Airplane, and Jimi Hendrix, basically the top acts of the day. And the festival is largely remembered as one of the most iconic events of the 1960s. Fast forward to 1994, and the organizers of the original decided to put on another Woodstock festival for the 25th anniversary, this time with alternative rock acts like Green Day, The Cranberries, and Nine Inch Nails, alongside some of the same bands that performed in 1969. Now, when it came time to put on another Woodstock festival for the 30th anniversary in 1999, a lot had changed, both in the culture and what music was popular in the late 90s. Both docs cover similar territory, but Nam, having seen both films, I want to know what you think of the organizers trying to recapture the feeling of the 1960s and throwing another Woodstock festival in the late 1990s.
I mean, watching the documentaries, I think a lot of it was driven by money But in the documentary, they say that they wanted to recapture that feeling of 1969 and give it to a new generation of kids to experience that environment. But I think after watching the documentaries, it was a little bit naive because obviously 1999 was a very different time from 1969. And I also thought it was really interesting that for 1999, there was only like three women performing.
In
the festival.
Top, as headliners anyway. I don't know if there were like ones at the emerging artist stage. But yeah, the top three headliners at the time were just like
three. And I remember hip hop at the time was very, very big. And I think they had DMX and Wyclef Jean.
Yeah.
And I think they had Wyclef Jean to kind of like for that spirit of Jimi Hendrix.
Yes.
So, yeah, we can say that if the intent was to have a new generation of kids experience 1969, okay. But then as we watch the documentaries, we find out that the spirit of 1969 might not have been what we all thought it was.
Yeah. I found a couple things interesting about sort of their planning and putting the 1999 festival together. One thing that I thought was interesting was just that I think there was an intent to do something about gun violence or address gun violence in a way. We just had Columbine happen a few months earlier. I think that the organizer, I think Michael Lang, who is the co-founder of Woodstock, really wanted to do something to give you something to, I guess, I'm struggling with what he was actually trying to accomplish. But basically, I think he wanted to give you something to...
Exactly.
No, I think he wanted to give them something positive to engage with. Sorry for that long pause, everybody. But, you know, I think that there were a few obvious big differences. I mean, first of all, you know, in 1969, you had the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And that galvanized people's attention in a big way.
It had a purpose, I guess.
It had a purpose, yeah. And I think also, you know, the setting was very different. I mean, in 1969, I think they were on a dairy farm. This time they were on an airbase. And I think part of the reason was because they didn't want people to sneak in because they'd had that issue, I think, in 94. People were sneaking in and they didn't
exactly
make any
money
off of it. Yeah.
What does Woodstock 69 have to do with an airbase?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, exactly. It's the antithesis if you think about it.
Yeah.
The priorities had changed. I mean, if you're trying to make money, I mean, that's going to obviously inform the decisions you make. And I think that, you know, the docs kind of explore what the consequences were.
And be honest about
that,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, the lineup of Woodstock 99 was, as you mentioned, you know, very different in terms of the types of music that were featured. It was very rock heavy. There was a genre of rock called, well, rock and rap called nu metal, which if you don't know is basically a mashup of both those genres, and it's mostly performed by white bands.
Can I give you an example?
Please.
My name is Kay.
Oh, God. I thought, you know what? I thought you were going to do I Did It All for the Nookie. What? The Nookie. And honestly, nu metal, one of probably the worst genres of music. But here are some of the bands that were performing. And just this is a very eclectic mix here. Mm-hmm. James Brown, he actually
Legend.
Opened the show.
Yeah.
Wyclef Jean, as you mentioned. DMX, as you mentioned. Sheryl Crow. Jewel. Alanis Morissette. Okay. Those are, you know, I think pretty good artists, I would say. Here it gets a little dicey. Limp Bizkit. And we're going to talk a bit about Limp Bizkit because they had a big part of Woodstock 99. Korn, another new metal band. Bush, a popular sort of post-grunge band of the late 90s. And then the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who closed the festival. And, you know, as the films both show, this was a pretty rock-friendly, dude-heavy festival. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know. What did you think of the lineup here?
Well, you missed another band that was there, Megadeth.
Oh, of course. I missed a few bands. There are a lot of bands. Fatboy Slim was another artist who was there.
Jamiroquai.
It was very...
Moby.
I think, you know, that time... I think what their film is trying to show is... Both films are kind of saying is that the genre of nu metal, sort of, it's very aggressive. Limp Bizkit in particular. Fred Durst does a song called Break Stuff, mm-hmm. and he just really gets the crowd amped, and he's like, and they start tearing things down, and it's just like, you know, he's not doing anything to sort of calm them down.
Yeah, you know, I noticed that both docs did touch about the band selection, and I don't know if that was the problem. I think that people can get into an environment and listen to different types of music from different backgrounds and have a great time. I think if you looked at 1969, there was a lot of artists that might not have, you know, been found on the same radio station. I mean, I know politics back then was very different from 1999. I think there was a lot of pent-up frustration because the minute you walked into the venue in Rome, New York for 1999, people had brought water, food. They took it, right? And they were charging like $4 for food.
Water.
For water, yeah. Even for pretzels, $4 for a pretzel. And by the end of day one on Friday, everything was kind of starting to disintegrate. And a lot of these artists that we mentioned hadn't even performed yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a cop-out for, I don't know, saying that people with different music tastes can't come together and have a good time. I felt sorry. I felt bad for the female artists because...
Definitely.
You know, you have these guys in the audience and they're, you know, saying, show us your, you know.
yeah.
I was really impressed with Offspring because we were working, I didn't really get a chance to, I saw some of it. Like I saw the stuff that Red Hot Chili Peppers did and Limp Bizkit. But when Offspring was saying to the crowd, you know, just because a girl's walking around at the top on doesn't mean that you can just grab her, you know, like be mindful, be polite, be respectful.
And they also said, you know, if you see a guy grab him by the, you know what.
That's okay.
but I think, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think it was good of them to say that.
Yeah. So I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, you know, when you say that, it's you're saying that these people can't vibe to,
true.
This, you know, but I think it's just the way people were treated. It was great to have all these different, you know, they had a rave area.
Yes, rave time, yeah.
I remember getting up at like 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, I didn't. I don't think we slept, but I left where we were staying at like 3 a.m. to go film Moby because I was a videographer, and it was really cool to see, you know, to be in that environment where it's just like the lights, so many people in one area, Moby on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I think they put a lot of effort in thinking about the experiences, but I don't think they put enough effort into thinking about the people who were there, how they would be taken care of. Do we have enough places for them to use the bathroom? There's a shower scene in the HBO one where you see that they had the showers next to each other for the guys and the girls, and the guys were just walking over and peeking and looking at the girls.
Yeah.
water fountains were limited. There was nowhere to sit. There was no shade. It got really hot. People were hiding underneath the trucks for had the equipment that were televising it. And so I don't think they put enough time in thinking about how the people who were there, who were making them the money that they wanted to make that profit, they didn't take enough time to think about their experience.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right. I think the infrastructure just wasn't in place. And I think you're right. People can enjoy different types of music. I've been to music festivals and it's, you know, you have rap, you have
Coachella,
rock. Yeah, exactly. You have all sorts of things. But I want to touch on what you mentioned about women and just how they were treated. Now, this part of the conversation we're going to have is dealing with sexual assault. And so content warnings apply. Both docs show us just the awful misogyny and sexual violence that occurred. And many of the women who attended reported being sexually assaulted afterwards. And we see actually in the doc lots of footage that was taken of women being groped, you know, in the crowd. I know some were who are crowd surfing. I don't think we see this, but one woman reported being assaulted in front of the stage.
Yeah. No one did anything.
I mean, this was just terrible. I mean, this was, and I remember hearing about this after, because I watched this on Much Music at the time, but I didn't know about, obviously, the assaults that took place. What did you have any inkling of that was going on?
Yeah. I mean, it's so weird what you block out, because when I was watching specifically the HBO doc, I started to remember a lot of things because we were in a work environment where I think our living quarters were nicer. I didn't have to look for water. We had a lot of walking and all that. But I think back now that when I did do the Moby shoot, I went by myself.
Oh, dear.
Myself on a camera at 2-3 o'clock in the morning to the venue, shot it, and then came back to where everybody was staying. And that kind of makes me angry because anything could have happened to me.
Yeah.
But there wasn't anything in place for that. And that was the era that women lived. I remember when we did a thing for Much Music. We used to do these shows called Snow Job, which meant that we went to, like during the winter, we went to like Florida and did a show in Florida where we're on the beach having fun. And I remember one time being made to wear a bikini. I didn't want to wear a bikini on camera. I didn't feel comfortable being in a bikini on camera. And I was made to wear it, and I was super uncomfortable, right? Mm. So that was the time where women weren't really asked of, you know, how you feel about things. Remember, that was the era of Girls Gone Wild.
Yeah.
They were selling these videos at night of young girls. A lot of them, for me anyway, they looked underage, where they were you know, taking off their tops and flashing their breasts.
Yeah.
And, you know, kissing each other and stuff. And that stuff was on television commercials.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know.
Big popular in college dorms.
Yeah. Sure. And it wasn't seen as a big deal. In the HBO documentary, you see the promoter of Woodstock 99, like, blame the women for being harassed. Like, you know, the problem was that there was a lot of girls walking around without their shirts. Why were they? What did they expect was going to happen to them?
That was awful.
It was awful.
And I think they say that in both docs.
In both docs, yeah. And so if you are trying to recreate the spirit of 1969, that was the spirit of 1969. That was a time when women were really trying to own their sexuality in a political environment that told them to just sit in the corner and be quiet.
Mm.
So that was a different time and era, but you're trying to recreate it in 1969 at a time when women are just seen as kind of like window dressing.
Yeah.
And we really need to have a conversation about what's happening to our young boys. You know, we've tried to cover this on the agenda, and
yep.
People get really strong feelings about it. But there is a problem. There's a problem of entitlement, feeling like you're entitled to certain things. And I found it interesting that both docs kind of tried to touch on that. But I think the HBO one did it better. What did you think?
I liked the HBO's approach to it because I think, you know, we got – it takes a more 30,000-foot view. And they interview journalists who may not have been there, mm-hmm. but were able to kind of provide context to some of the culture that was – to the environment that we're in. I mean, I think Wesley Morris, who we've actually had on the agenda
before.
Yeah,
he was great. You produced it.
And you did. You know, he talks a bit about just, you know, this is the same era as the Monica Lewinsky scandal and how she was sort of disposable, you know, to the Clinton administration, basically.
Didn't Kid Rock on stage at Woodstock 99, he said.
Good point.
Yeah,
he actually said, you know, Bill Clinton's a pimp and Monica's a...
H-O-E.
Yeah, exactly.
And the crowd went crazy.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a very pre-Me Too event.
Yeah, and I would even say that a lot of girls there probably believed it because during the Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton scandal, I was like, well, she shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Right? So it was a very different time from, we were having this conversation, what is it, 20 years later?
Oh my God. 23 years later. Jeez.
Jeez, we're so old. Anyway, I'm so old. We're doing this, but this, it's a very different time to, we've had like 2 decades to kind of think about what happened in 1999, and we can say, oh, we should have seen it coming, but I don't know if we can.
No, it's kind of hindsight is 2020 sort
yeah.
of thing. Well, the festival, you know, it was 3 days long, and you were there for all three of it.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end, it was just outright pandemonium. The organizers, I don't know why they did this, but they gave a not-for-profit group was handing out candles. They were going to do a candlelight vigil.
Don't laugh, though, but again, it's okay. So they gave these candles out, a non-profit group was giving candles out to the participants there, right?
Yes.
But remember, again, Woodstock 69 was about peace, love, and happiness.
I know, right? I know. I think a lot of this stuff, I think you can say in hindsight was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Because obviously they didn't know or couldn't have, maybe they couldn't have foreseen, but someone probably should have thought this through.
Yeah.
They're handing out these candles to a very volatile crowd. And what are they going to do? They're going to set fire. And that's what basically happened. They destroyed the place.
Yeah.
So you saw this, right? Like, you saw the fires. Like, what did you think?
Well, can we haven't mentioned the mud. Or the porta potty.
Well, we haven't mentioned, I mean, the sanitation was terrible.
It was disgusting.
No
the smell,
clean water. Yeah.
The smell. So the first day from Friday... oh my gosh, the porta potties overflowed. So the stuff in the porta potties got mixed with water and people were playing in it because they thought it was mud.
Ugh.
But it was fecal matter, right?
Yeah.
And so people were walking around and a lot of people that Ed was talking to were covered in this stuff. And of course, Ed is like, you smell like...
And they got sick from it. Some people got sick, right?
Well, it's like, I don't know if it's like a mob mentality, but again, I think a lot of those people were trying to recapture what they saw in 1969. In 1994, it rained mostly, so people were walking around covered in mud. But this time around, it wasn't. So it was, the sanitation was awful. People didn't have access to water, but you can have beer.
Yeah, and that made them dehydrate faster.
Exactly.
And
younger
anyway.
Kids drinking, and it wasn't like they were checking ID or anything.
No, terrible security.
I mean, was there security?
Well, they called them the Peace Patrol, but they basically were just like given like a 3-hour class or something like that? And
yeah,
then there was no real training after that.
So Woodstock 99 was what, 300,000, 350,000
yeah.
people? They had about 10,000 people doing security.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, what is the point?
Well, you know, it just, not well planned out at all. And actually, I know we got to have to wrap up, but I, you know, we've watched both docs, the HBO and the Netflix one. Do you have a preference? Like, which one do you think, if you didn't want to watch all, like both, mm-hmm. which one would you say people should watch?
I would do the Netflix one. And
okay.
this is why, because you see a lot of what was happening behind the scenes. Because the promoters and the organizers would like us to believe that, oh, we didn't foresee this coming. But in the Netflix one, you see how they were trying to cut things because the budget, they needed to make a profit. You have footage from the people who were part of the organizing committee. And it's people who were there, like the journalists were there. They're bigger names. Jewel, I think they spoke to. Jewel was in both documentaries.
And so is Jonathan Davis.
Yeah.
And
what's his, I forget his name. Gwen Stefani's ex-husband.
Oh, Gavin Rossdale.
Oh, how do I forget a face like that? he was in the Netflix one. And Ananda Lewis, who I loved at MTV, she was in that one.
Right.
So I think it gives you a different perspective because it was the people that were there and what was happening behind the scenes.
Yeah.
I think the HBO one does a little different, like a bigger picture.
It does, yeah.
But it has the best quote from the promoter where he's just like, he's still blaming everybody but himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's Limp Bizkit's fault. It's
yes.
the artists. It's the crowd. It's the girls.
A handful of knuckleheads, yeah.
Knuckleheads. It's MTV. Like, he dared to blame MTV because MTV was broadcasting what was happening there.
Yeah.
So I thought that piece was just kind of like, wow, dude, you haven't even learned anything.
Yeah. I it's hard for you to pick one. I think if you're a Woodstock 99 completist like I am, I would watch both because I think there's some value to watching both and getting the different perspectives. And I think they do, even though they're kind of covering the same territory a lot, there is there is a lot of overlap. But I would just say that what I liked about the HBO one is that they are getting people who are able to kind of provide different critical lenses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think interviewing Wesley Morris and another journalist, Maureen Callahan, to sort of provide sort of a racial or a gender lens to the events and sort of talking about what society was like back then was pretty valuable. So I would recommend watching that as well. I think it was interesting that the promoters agreed to be in both docs.
I know.
And actually, Michael Lang passed away this year.
Oh, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's one of the, like, I should, I think it,
he's the creator of 1969.
He's one of the co-founder. He was in 1969.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was interesting that they took part in it. And I think part of that may have something to do with just wanting to maintain the narrative.
Mm.
Because I think that, you know, we see them in press conferences during Woodstock 99 trying to defend what's happening and pushing back really hard against journalists who are asking very critical questions about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And that was from like day one.
Basically,
so
yeah.
if you address those problems at day one, you might not have ended up with on day three with everything burning after the fact, finding out all these, the number of rapes that have happened,
mm-hmm.
the sexual assaults, you know, someone died.
Yes.
And
that's actually in the HBO version.
Yeah.
We find out that an attendee passed away tragically there. He, I think, died of hypothermia.
But did he? Because they're saying that they didn't have the right people to take care of him.
Oh, that's
so
right, yeah.
He might not have died if they actually, that was something that the promoters thought about.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of felt like they were always 10 steps behind. And yeah, I thought it was interesting that they would be in both documentaries. But I guess there's something to be said about when you believe your truth, you're going to cling to it, which is unfortunate because we've seen since then, like Coachella started in 1999,
that's right, yeah.
later that year. And they knew how to do it. Different artists. When people were coming into Coachella, they were giving them bottles of water.
Yep.
They did it right. And for the promoter in the HBO doc to kind of maintain his stance, I thought was disrespectful to the people who were hurt at this festival. The young man who died. You have to take accountability. You have to. But, yeah.
Well, one last question for you. Have you been to a music festival since?
Does Caravana count?
I think so. Is
yeah, I've
festival?
Been to Caravana.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I've been to Caravana, and I've been to Glastonbury in the UK. Of course, my UK husband would say I'm saying it wrong. Glastonbury?
yeah,
but I've been
right.
there. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I always know the exits, you know. I know where my exits are and just like aware of my body at all times.
And stay hydrated.
Yeah.
And that's the podcast. You can stream Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage on Crave, and Trainwreck, Woodstock 99 is on Netflix.
If you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about us. It helps new listeners to find the show.
This episode was produced by yours truly and Matthew O'Mara and edited by Matthew O'Mara. Special thanks to our production support coordinators, Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell.
Our manager for podcasts is Sharaya Tajvidi, and our executive producer for digital is Lori Few.
Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you at the next screening.